Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and we are kicking off a great episode tonight. I'm looking forward to the topic, and we'll get into that here in just a second. Of course, but we can't do anything else until we bring up my co-host, Sam Bradley, who is coming to us after checking out some glitches. We've got you back up on your iPad, I believe, right, Sam?
Yes, it's an iPad day. For some reason, the computer didn't seem to want to, or Skype didn't seem to want to work on the computer. But, you know, that's just how things go in the world of electronics. So, we have both, two out of the three of our meteorologists tonight, and we're going to focus on certainly one of them. We got both Dan and Becky DePodwin. So, Bex, what's new in the weather? Anything?
It's been pretty snowy here, actually. We've had snow several of the last days here. We'll get lake effect snow showers in the winter, and so we'll get bursts of a couple hours of snow. It'll accumulate a little bit and then be done, which is nice. Jamie, I don't know if it reaches all the way down there for you, if you just had dry weather.
It's been pretty dry here.
Yeah. Other than that, I'm not super in touch with the weather, hence why I brought in a backup.
Ah, that would be Dan, who's in touch with the weather, I'm sure. What can you tell us, Dan?
Oh, yes. Well, as Becky was saying, it's been snowy here, and that's sort of, I think, the trend in a lot of parts of the country here over the next week or so. And I think maybe one of the biggest stories is the fact that we finally have some precipitation in the southwestern U.S., where they've been in a terrible drought. So, good news for them with rain and some higher elevation snow down in Southern California. And the next big event further east might be an area of accumulating snow Monday and Tuesday from somewhere in the Midwest eastward through the Ohio Valley into the Northeast.
Hmm. Yeah, we haven't had a whole lot going on here of anything, actually, which is okay. I'm fine with that. So, tonight, we're going to talk about, well, you know, I've been thinking, Jamie, we're almost 9 years into this thing. And, you know, every once in a while, I throw it out there that we should probably reintroduce ourselves. But I think as long as we've been doing this and the fact that, you know, that we have such an amazing group, I'd like to dig in a little deeper and talk about who we are and what we do. And by the way, Joe's here, right? I can't see the faces anymore. You got Dr. Joe on?
I'm here.
You're there. Okay, Joe. Good to hear from you. Any case, I thought it'd be kind of a fun thing to do that. So I'm going to pick on Becky tonight. She's been with us a couple years. And, you know, just looking at her signature, I want to know about all that stuff that's on there. And then, you know, Becky does a lot of really cool things, and we're going to talk about some of that. So, Becky, we know you're a meteorologist. That's what everybody knows. How long you been doing that? And how'd you get started on it? How'd you get interested in it?
So I've been a professional meteorologist for over a decade now. I got my first job in the field in early 2009 when I was still actually in college going to school for meteorology. But even earlier than that, it's, you know, every meteorologist has, you know, sort of a story, an event, or something that got them interested in the weather. I swear I was born with it. I don't know, maybe it's just growing up in Colorado, there's always a lot of exciting snowstorms, things like that. But I've always loved the weather. So for me, it wasn't so much what sparked my interest in meteorology. That was just always a passion that was there. But it was what sort of shifted my focus within meteorology and has sort of guided my path through my career to be where I am today, which is kind of at the intersection of meteorology, emergency management, risk communication, business continuity. When I was in college, in undergrad, this was right after my freshman year of college, an EF3 tornado hit my hometown of Windsor, Colorado.
Oh, yes.
And I had been storm chasing that day, not in Colorado. I had gone to Kansas. And so we all sort of thought people were joking with us because it was the tornado tracked in between the town where I went to college and through my hometown. And so it was just in our backyard. How could that have happened when we were going to Kansas? And it was a whole thing. But obviously it wasn't a joke. It had happened. I remember calling my mom and telling her to take shelter because she was out looking at the hail that was falling. And then the next day I drove back into town, into my hometown, you know, where I'd lived my entire life. And I saw the damaged homes. I talked to friends and neighbors whose cars had been completely destroyed. I talked to my piano teacher whose piano was completely out of tune after the tornado went through. I, you know, talked to people to see how they received warning, how and where they took shelter. And it was just one of those things that was really, really eye-opening that for the first time I realized this science that I had been so passionate about and was going to school for and getting a whole degree in was about people. People were impacted by the weather, by this thing that I had always loved and been so fascinated by. And so from that point on, my focus sort of shifted from the science aspect to how it impacts people and how people respond and react and prepare for weather disasters. What makes them take action? How do we communicate in a way that will, be actionable and keep people safe? I guess it all sort of comes back to the risk communication aspect. But that sort of came a little bit later. It was just sort of a seed that was planted at that point in time. So I finished my degree, was working for a small company in Cheyenne, Wyoming called Day Weather, putting together a newspaper weather pages and doing radio broadcasts for parts of the Western U.S. And then I eventually was hired by AccuWeather Enterprise Solutions at the time, which was the severe weather center of AccuWeather located in Wichita, Kansas. So I spent a few years in the heart of Tornado Alley, where I had an encounter with a tornado once again. An EF2 tornado hit my apartment after only having lived there for about 3 months. Again, another pretty eye-opening experience. I learned a lot about the various myths that people believe, that apparently the tornadoes don't cross the Arkansas River, that Wichita doesn't get tornadoes, even though one hit Andover, like 2 decades before. So it was really eye-opening. Like, people are impacted by this all the time, whether it's just, is it going to be sunny? Is it going to be rainy or snowy? To, very, very impactful things like tornadoes that, uproot people's lives and, obviously can be deadly. So the job I was doing there was really, really fantastic, and I did enjoy it a lot. But I also wanted to kind of do more and see what else was out there. So I eventually ended up transferring to the AccuWeather headquarters in State College. Dan may have also had some small part to do with that as we met through work. He was in the State College office, and I was in the Wichita office, and that is how we kind of met and started. We became friends and then started dating. And then I eventually moved, and I've now been in State College, Pennsylvania for maybe 7 years this summer. And I did shift work forecasting for a while and eventually then decided to go back for a master's in emergency management. I realized I didn't like operational forecasting very much. And so I just thought a lot about what was it that made me excited, and enthusiastic and passionate. What did it really, when I thought about it, what impact did I want to have on the world when it comes to my career? And so I sort of came back around to emergency management. So I got the master's and have sort of been carving out a bit of a niche within the private sector and trying to figure out how we can work with our clients to help them be as prepared as possible and keep their employees safe. Yeah, that was a lot.
So I love that story, Becky. It's intriguing as hell. And of course, meteorology in general is intriguing to me. I think you made weather junkies out of all of us. And of course, hearing how you and Dan got together somewhere along the way. But I got to know, when you guys are at home, how much discussion do you have about the weather?
Too much. We do. We talk about it a lot. He likes to monger is the phrase we use. He likes to monger snowstorms, and I like to pretend they're not going to happen until they happen, so I'm pleasantly surprised when we actually get snow. But it's it's fun. It's fun when we actually get, you know, exciting weather here, because we both just nerd out about it together.
Well, I'll tell you one thing, too. You know, whenever you talk about that Windsor tornado, which, of course, is a stone's throw away from me,
yeah,
it makes me really nervous. So I hope it's the last big one that's going to come around here, because that could not make me happy. Let's pick up on some of the other things you do. You're on the AMS, which is the Meteorological Society. I knew I wouldn't say that right. Board for Early Career Professionals. That sounds intriguing. You're the chair for that group. What is it you do?
Well, I'm almost no longer the chair. I am concluding my year as chair. I've been on the board for 3 years. But it's basically designed, the Early Career Board was developed about 7 or 8 years ago. And it was designed to help bridge the gap between when people are meteorology students and then when they're in their mid to late career. They realized there was a drop-off in membership in that time frame for any number of reasons. You know, people couldn't afford the dues. They didn't really see the benefits of the society. So what the board does is engage with these early career professionals. So people who are in their first, it's technically, you know, I think defined as 10 to 15 years after your bachelor degree, and just make sure that people realize the benefits of networking within the society, of going to conferences and learning new information and meeting people who could possibly give you a job or point you in the direction of a mentor. So it's all about, you know, connection, and I think just helping early career professionals succeed within this industry and the enterprise, because it can be difficult, you know, your first couple of years when you're first getting started, you may be living alone, you know, depending on if you had to move for a job or something like that. So it's just letting people know there's a support system out there within the society.
That's good to know. Dan, I'm sure you have some thoughts on that.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, first, I would say I don't monger, as Becky says. I'm a very good meteorologist who is accurate and at many times, and sometimes inaccurate. But I know Becky gives me a hard time for the snow forecast. I do. I love snowstorms in the Northeast, especially, and I can get pretty excited, especially like we had earlier in December when we had 13 inches of snow.
You had a very good forecast for that storm, I will say.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I get a little credit. But I think I'm very active within AMS, not as active as Becky is. She's done a great job with the society. The society is great, though. I mean, we have annual meetings. This year was virtual, which was last week, which was challenging, but also good in some ways. And it's just a great opportunity to meet people who love the weather, but who do different things that you, in some cases, never heard of before. And it's great to be able to meet new people and learn a whole lot of new information that you wouldn't really see perhaps in your day-to-day job.
Very intriguing. Well, you're just like an AMS star, Becky. You're also on the BEST committee and the Early Career Leadership Academy, which might have been kind of what you were just talking about. What's the BEST committee?
So that is the Board on Enterprise Strategic Topics. It sits under the Commission for the Climate, Weather, Water, Enterprise. And the BEST board sits over several different other committees. So we sort of are the parent committee of this, but then we're also responsible for planning one of the symposiums that makes up the annual meeting. So that's what I was in charge of last week. One of the things was being the program chair for a 5-day symposium within the larger conference. So making sure that we had, you know, a good diverse set of topics for the sessions. We had panel sessions. We had sessions with a variety of different talks, all sorts of different topics, everything from wildfire to marine to partnerships to communicating weather in the Spanish language, all sorts of really, really interesting stuff. But planning that is a ton of work. And then the other thing is the Early Career Leadership Academy, which is sort of related to the Board for Early Career Professionals. It's sort of sits under that. And that's a program that's, again, designed to bring together a diverse group of early career professionals from all across the weather enterprise and sort of help develop them into a cohort where we talk about leadership, basically. And it's that's supposed to be a several-month lead-up where we have webinars and group calls, and then it culminates in an in-person meeting, which, again, unfortunately, like most things, is now turning virtual in March.
Well, out of necessity. So, Dan, are you involved in any of these things, or is that just a Becky thing?
Well, she's involved in those. I'm involved in a couple committees. It's a little more technical. The one I'm most involved in is the Radio Spectrum Allocation Committee, which is, I think, too technical for this conversation, and we'd say it for another time. But basically, it's we look at how the radio spectrum, which is basically like any type of radio waves, right? You listen to the radio, you all the weather satellites transmit data in parts of the radio spectrum. We look at how that's apportioned to make sure that we can get the data we need and not be interfered with. That's the Cliff Notes version of it. And I'm also heavily involved in some of the in the AccuWeather planning of the annual meeting. We have a big presence at AccuWeather each year in the annual meeting, and I've sort of taken a lead on that in past years of making sure our exhibit is set up correctly and everything, and we're involved in different activities that we have to be involved in while we're there.
Well, Jamie loves that techie stuff, so we'll have to talk more about it later. Any questions, Jamie? I can't see y'all because I went from the computer to the iPad to the phone. So we'll have to just call you out.
I don't have any specific questions, but I think it's important for us to kind of get a little bit of these tastes of each other's backgrounds periodically. And just fascinating all the stuff that Becky and Dan are involved with.
I don't know when they have time to breathe, frankly. Let's talk about this thing you were telling us about, Becky. It's called an extreme event, and I had no idea until I went to the website you sent me to. But it's an award-winning in-person role-playing game that gives participants a taste of what it takes to build community resilience in the face of disaster. And so all of these, well, I've done this like with Ski Patrol and with, the feds doing a similar type of thing where it's just kind of a tabletop exercise, basically. But I noticed that it's meant for different groups of people, from teachers to CERT groups to, people within the disaster world and in the private sector, too, I can imagine. So tell us more about that. It's really fascinating.
Yeah, so both Kyle and I went through the pilot program of their facilitator training in December. So they're trying to really ramp up, scale up the game here and get a lot more people certified in being able to facilitate it. It has a global presence. It has been played, I think, in several different countries. It's intended to be for anywhere from 12 to 48 players, usually lasts about an hour. And there are three disaster scenarios: hurricane, flooding, and earthquake. And the idea is that there's sort of five themes. The five themes are: everyone has a role to play. It's all about coalitions. We're all in this together. You can't plan for everything. And resilience starts at home. And so it basically takes people through a scenario. The facilitator will read the scenario. I guess first everyone gets separated out into different groups. So you have community members, you have firefighters, EMS, you have, I forget what the different ones are, just residents, people who live in the area, police. And as you're in these different groups, you realize you have these cards that are different resources. So you have a generator, or you have extra food, you have walkie-talkies to be able to communicate. And the idea is that you have to take all of these resources and figure out which ones are the best ones for the scenario that you're dealing with. And then in the middle of the scenario, the facilitator can kind of throw in a curveball and have like a bridge go out or a, you know, a dam breaks. And so there's more flooding in this area. And it's all about discussion. It's all about having these small group discussions and, you know, figuring out what you need to do to help your city survive whatever this particular disaster is.
God, I love it. Joe, that's kind of right up your alley. What do you think about that? I hadn't heard about it before.
Yeah, I hadn't either. I'm actually curious, are these things open to, like, the public, or do you have to be in the industry, so to speak?
So I think it can work any number of ways. Anybody can play the game. You can request a facilitator. You can also download the materials and facilitate it yourself. I believe that is an option. I think they're trying to spin up people who are a bit more well-versed in how to facilitate something like this, as it can be a pretty large group to manage. And obviously you want people who have some knowledge of disasters and how to, you know, talk about things. But I really could be taken and utilized anywhere.
Yeah, it's developed by the National Academy of Sciences Koshland Science Museum, which they now call Lab X. And they collaborate with Resilient America Roundtable. And, you know, there's actually a council report called Disaster Resilience, a national imperative, which you could probably grab. So it kind of involves all of those things from what I learned about it. It just sounds fascinating. And who knew? Even Joe didn't know. Joe knows everything. So what do you think, Jamie?
Well, I mean, we've talked about resilience and the importance of preparedness here on the show. I don't know how many times. I mean, it comes up quite frequently. Community resilience is a major determinator of what, you know, how well a community will survive a given event. And, you know, we've seen how communities that are less resilient, or even parts of communities that are less resilient, are impacted so much by different things. I mean, we saw that, you know, Katrina is a great example of that. We've seen it in Houston when the severe flooding happened a few years back during the hurricane. And some communities fared better than others. And you know, often, of course, that's related to socioeconomic factors. And so I wonder, Becky, how does it apply sort of the socioeconomic factors and things like that to the scenarios as well?
That's a good question. I think to an extent it does, because everyone who is playing the game is going to bring with it their personal life experience. You know, I guess it depends on the people that you have in the room. I'd have to look through the card specifically, which I could go grab. They're just a couple of feet away, to see what types of resources that the game gives you, and how those might play into that question a little bit.
I just could see this, you know, different stakeholders and parts in some communities would, you know, be, I think this would be a great way to bring in, like, you know, faith leaders and things like that, that are leaders in their communities, to help, you know, encourage the members of their congregations to become more resilient and prepared, because it would help them understand the different needs during different types of events. I mean, I there's a lot of ways you could apply this.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a really interesting game, and I think it definitely depends on who the people are in the room. You can get kids to play it, and they're going to have obviously a much different take on, you know, whatever that specific disaster is. You're going to get, you know, if you have firefighters or EMS or police in the room, they're going to think about the resources totally differently. So I would be interested to see if at some point they do some kind of white paper or study and take away some of the feedback that people provide as they play the game, and what themes sort of emerge, to, you know, based on, depending on who's playing.
Yeah, Joe, I could imagine.
Well, you know,
I was going to say, Joe, I would wonder if this would be a way to help different groups that are training for different things to think outside of the box, to kind of break out of their silos and think about things from a different perspective.
Yeah, I was thinking actually exactly the same. You know, there's introducing sort of novel ways to learn, like this game, quote unquote, you know, are often beneficial, especially for folks that are very new to that area of study. It's a nice way to sort of introduce people and get them thinking about things in a bit of a different way.
Well, one thing I noticed too is every community is so different, and I can't tell you how many of these exercises we've done on different scales and myself in different roles, but one of the things it does is it enhances communication between different factors involved in a disaster. It kind of helps you connect with some of those key people, so you have this dialogue going already, and you know who to ask questions of. And it also, as you go through a scenario, you go, oh, crap, we probably could have one of those. I didn't even realize we didn't have one. Or who does have one? Who could we go to get one? I mean, all of these kind of things. You don't want to wait until a disaster happens and then start asking those questions, right, Bex?
Well, right, exactly. I think that's, you know, part of, you know, one of the key aspects of this is to whoever's in the room to get them thinking about, you know, what could happen, you know, what sort of, you know, loops could they be thrown during a disaster that they may not have thought of. Nothing ever goes according to plan. I think that's a pretty understood thing in the world of disaster planning. You can have the best plan in the world, but it's never going to go quite the way that you anticipate it to. So being able to pivot quickly and communicate well across all the different, you know, sectors and groups that you have to be in contact with to respond to something is really critical.
Lastly, Beck, as we roll down here, you're very involved in the mental health aspect of meteorology, which is not something I would have given a lot of thought to before I met you, but obviously, meteorologists, like every other group of people, and when you're dealing with severe weather situations, it does make a lot of sense that this is going to be a tough road for them, especially as you have a disaster that's going on and on and on. You know, I commend you for that because it's really important.
Yeah, we forecast disasters and then we watch them unfold. And, you know, for a lot of people, particularly National Weather Service forecasters, the disasters that they're forecasting are in their backyard. They're happening to their family as they're working and trying to keep the public safe. And there's also the shift work aspect of it, which, you know, I'm sure a lot of EMS people are familiar with. It's you sleep at very odd hours. You don't get enough sleep. It's a stressful job. And all of that really takes a toll. And we've talked a lot about the critical incident stress and the cumulative stress aspects of these types of jobs.
Well, that's what's interesting is I wouldn't have drawn a parallel to EMS and meteorology, but the more we talk about it, the more I see it's there. Dan, anything you want to throw in as we wind down here?
No, I would just agree. I mean, I think what the work that Becky's done and a lot of other folks in the field have done on the intersection of mental health and meteorology has been fantastic. It's something that I wasn't as aware of. And as a manager now of a team of operational meteorologists, I have relied a lot on Becky and others and, you know, really learn about this and to be able to apply some of these best practices and understand what's happening and the challenges that people face working shift work or whatever it might be. So I think it's a great conversation and it's excellent. It's being discussed and is being brought to the forefront, and it's making us change how we operate, which is great because we're doing it for the better.
Absolutely. Joe, final thoughts?
Well, mute button. Well, I apart from learning how to work the mute button, sorry, I'm thinking about what Dan just said as far as this confluence of the mental health aspects of it, as well as, you know, part of what sort of I think fascinated me is that, like medicine, meteorology as a science has lots of different facets to it, and that it is a very broad-ranging area of science. And like many other areas of science, it bleeds over into other areas of science, for example, the mental health stuff. So, you know, there's the more you learn, the more you appreciate that there's a lot more to learn.
That makes perfect sense. So, Jamie, we're always talking about training and preparedness. This is just another way to do it. And I, you know, amazed that there's something like that out there.
No, I mean, I think these types of things, these games or whatever you want to call it, that help people come together and gain a new understanding for something that is difficult to approach with people. You know, preparedness is something that every community strives for, and every emergency manager I've ever met struggles with getting more than, say, 5 to 10% of their community in any level of preparedness at any given time, because people just ignore it until it's right on top of them. And so having something like this that would give maybe some leaders in different parts of communities a different understanding for why resilience and preparedness are important, could go a long way to helping with that. And you know, it brings us back around full circle with what Paragon Medical Education Group does and their unique training scenarios, where they take responders and people from different jurisdictions all over the country and even around the world, and prepare them to go into communities and respond. And Joe, you know, you guys do such a great job with that and customize it to specific needs. You know, these types of changes and with games and things like that could give you a definite, you know, different way to bring something to the table.
Yeah, it's been sort of fascinating. I was thinking about not only the addition of the gaming aspect, but the weather has such a huge influence on all things disaster in general, whether it's the cause or the challenge of responding during one of these weather events. That's just something else we could roll into our classes as we go forward.
How can folks reach out to you if they want to get a look at what kind of customized things you can do for them?
Well, we're always happy to talk to folks so we can customize the experience for them at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or our Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group on Facebook, or always to the Disaster Podcast.
And we do continue to thank you for your support that brings the Disaster Podcast to folks every week. And thank you so much for that. Dan, where can folks reach out to you if they want to see what you're up to and talking about?
Find me on Twitter at WX Depot, also LinkedIn and Facebook.
Excellent. Thank you for coming on tonight. It was great having you here.
Absolutely.
Becky, how about you?
Real quick, I do want to give a shout out. I should have said this at the beginning, to Epicenter Innovations. They were the group that hosted the training, for the facilitator training for LabX. So they're in partnership and they did a fantastic job. And I've enjoyed working with them and being a part of it. So quick shout out to them. We should have them on the show at some point. I can be found on Twitter at WX_Bex, on LinkedIn and Facebook at Becky DePodwin.
Awesome. And Sam, how about you?
Well, I'm in all those same places under Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, certainly in our just amazing and ever-growing Facebook group and disasterpodcast.com. How about you, Jamie?
You can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. So please friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. And of course, at the Disaster Podcast Facebook group, which is continuing to grow all the time, and as well as disasterpodcast.com, where on each episode page, right there at the top below the player, there is a series of links where you can subscribe to the show however you'd like. So do that and make sure you don't miss any of our upcoming episodes. We've got a lot of great stuff coming up for you as we, as Sam said, roll into year number 9. So Sam, good episode here. Great topic. I want to hear more about this, actually.
Yeah, that's, I totally agree with you. Just things you never know, but you like learning. So So I guess we could say about this episode is disaster training is not our everyday training.